that week. The things you like anyway seem, in their very existence, to be worthy of celebration. The candied walnut vendor on Crosby Street, who always returns your wave as you jog past him. The falafel sandwich with extra pickled radish from the truck down the block that you woke up craving one night in London. The apartment itself, with its sunlight that lopes from one end to the other in the course of a day, with your things and food and bed and shower and smells. And, of course, there is the person you come back to. His face and body and voice and scent and touch. His way of waiting until you finish whatever you're saying, no matter how lengthy, before he speaks. The way his smile moves so slowly across his face that it reminds you of moonrise. How clearly he has missed you, and how clearly happy he is to have you back. Then there are the things, if you are particularly lucky, that this person has done for you while you're away. How in the pantry, in the freezer, in the refrigerator, will be all the food you like to eat, the scotch you like to drink. There will be the sweater you thought you lost the previous year at the theater, clean and folded and back on its shelf. There will be the shirt with its dangling buttons, but the buttons will be sewn back in place. There will be your mail stacked on one side of his desk. There will be a contract for an advertising campaign you're going to do in Germany for an Austrian beer, with his notes in the margin to discuss with your lawyer. And there will be no mention of it, and you will know that it was done with genuine pleasure, and you will know that part of the reason, a small part, but a part, you love being in this apartment and in this relationship is because this other person is always making a home for you, and that when you tell him this, he won't be offended, but pleased, and you'll be glad, because you mean it with gratitude. And in these moments, almost a week back home, you will wonder why you leave so often, and you will wonder whether, after the next year's obligations are fulfilled, you ought not just stay here for a period, where you belong. But you will also know, as he knows, that part of your constant leaving is reactive. After his relationship with Jude was made public, while he and Kit and Emil were waiting to see what would happen next, he had experienced that same insecurity that had visited him as a younger man. What if he never worked again? What if this was it? And although things had, he could now see, continued with almost no discernible hitch at all, it had taken him a year to be reassured that his circumstances hadn't changed, that he was still as he had been, desirable to some directors and not to others. Bullshit, Kit had said, and he was grateful for him. Anyone would want to work with you. And at any rate, the same actor, no better or worse than he had been before. But if he was allowed to be the same actor, he was not allowed to be the same person, and in the months after he was declared gay, and never refuted it, he didn't have a publicist to issue these sorts of denials and avowals, he found himself in possession of more identities than he'd had in a very long time. For much of his adult life, he had been placed in circumstances that required the shedding of selves. No longer was he a brother. No longer was he a son. But with a single revelation, he had now become a gay man. A gay actor. A high-profile gay actor. A high-profile non-participating gay actor. And finally, a high-profile traitorous gay actor. A year or so ago, he had gone to dinner with a director named Max, whom he'd known for many years, and over dinner Max had tried to get him to give a speech at a gala dinner benefiting a gay rights organization, at which he would announce himself as gay. Willem had always supported this organization, and he told Max that although he would be pleased to present an award or sponsor a table, as he had every year for the past decade, he wouldn't come out, because he didn't believe there was anything to come out of. He wasn't gay. Willem, Max said, you're in a relationship, a serious relationship, with a man. That is the very definition of gay. I'm not in a relationship with a man, he said, hearing how absurd the words were. I'm in a relationship with Jude. Oh my God, Max muttered. He'd sighed. Max was 16 years older than he. He had come of age in a time when identity politics were your very identity. And he understood Max's and the other people who pecked at and pleaded with him to come out and then accused him of self-loathing and cowardice and hypocrisy and denial when he didn't. Arguments. He understood that he had come to represent something he had never asked to represent. He understood that whether he wanted this representation or not was almost incidental. But he still couldn't do it. Jude had told him that he and Caleb had told no one in their lives about the other, and although Jude's secretiveness had been motivated by shame, and Caleb's, Willem could only hope, by at least some small glint of guilt, he too felt that his relationship with Jude existed to no one but themselves. It seemed something sacred and fought for, and unique to them. Of course, this was ridiculous, but it was the way he felt. To be an actor in his position was to be, in many ways, a possession, to be fought over and argued about and criticized by anyone who wanted to say something, anything about his abilities or appearance or performance. But his relationship was different. In it, he played a role for one other person, and that person was his only audience, and no one else ever saw it, no matter how much they thought they might. His relationship also felt sacred because he had just recently, in the last 6 months or so, felt he had gotten the rhythm of it. The person he thought he knew had turned out to be, in some ways, not the person before him, and it had taken him time to figure out how many facets he had yet to see. It was as if the shape he had all along thought was a pentagram was in reality a dodecahedron, many-sided and many-fractaled and much more complicated to measure. Despite this, he had never considered leaving. He stayed unquestioningly, out of love, out of loyalty, out of curiosity. But it hadn't been easy. In truth, it had been at times aggressively difficult, and in some ways remained so. When he had promised himself that he wouldn't try to repair Jude, he had forgotten that to solve someone is to want to repair them. To diagnose a problem and then not try to fix that problem seemed not only neglectful, but immoral. The primary issue was sex, their sexual life, and Jude's attitude about it. Toward the end of the 10-month period in which he and Jude had been together, and he had been waiting for him to be ready, the longest sustained period of celibacy he had endured since he was 15, and which he had accomplished as partly a challenge to himself, the way other people stopped eating bread or pasta because their boyfriends or girlfriends had stopped eating them as well. He had begun to seriously worry about where this was all going, and about whether sex was something Jude was simply not capable of. Somehow he knew, and had always known, that Jude had been abused, that something awful, maybe several things awful, had happened to him. But to his shame, he was unable to find the words to discuss it with him. He told himself that even if he could find the words, Jude wouldn't talk about it until he was ready. But the truth, Willem knew, was that he was too much of a coward, and that cowardice was really the only reason for his inaction. But then he had come home from Texas, and they'd had sex after all, and he had been relieved, and relieved too that he had enjoyed it as much as he had, that there had been nothing strained or unnatural about it, and when it turned out that Jude was much more sexually dexterous than he had assumed he would be, he allowed himself to be relieved a third time. He couldn't bring himself, however, to determine why Jude was so experienced. Had Richard been right? And had Jude been leading some sort of double life all this time? It seemed too tidy an explanation. And yet the alternative, that this was knowledge Jude had accumulated before they had met, which meant these would have been lessons learned in childhood, was overwhelming to him. And so, to his great guilt, he said nothing. He chose to believe the theory that made his life less complicated. One night, though, he'd had a dream that he and Jude had just had sex, which they had, and that Jude was next to him and crying, trying to stay silent and failing, and he knew, even in the dream, why he was crying. Because he hated what he was doing. He hated what Willem was making him do. The next night he had asked Jude outright, "Do you like this?" And he had waited, not knowing what the answer would be, until Jude had said yes, and then he had been relieved yet again. That the fiction could continue, that their equilibrium would remain unchanged, that he wouldn't have to have a conversation that he didn't know how to begin, much less lead. He had an image of a little boat, a dinghy, rocking wildly on the waves, but then righting itself again and sailing placidly on, even though the waters beneath it were black and filled with monsters and flows of seaweed that threatened with every current to pull the poor small boat beneath the ocean's surface, where it would glug out of sight and be lost. But every so often, too sporadically and randomly to track, there would be moments when he would see Jude's face as he pushed into him, or, after, would feel his silence, so black and total that it was almost gaseous. And he would know that Jude had lied to him, that he had asked him a question to which only one answer was acceptable. And Jude had given him that answer, but that he hadn't meant it. And then he would argue with himself, trying to justify his behavior, and reproving himself for it as well. But when he was being very honest, he knew there was a problem. Though he couldn't quite articulate what the problem was. After all, Jude always seemed to want to have sex whenever he did, though wasn't that suspicious in itself? But he had never met anyone who was so opposed to foreplay, who didn't want to even discuss sex, who never even said the very word. "This is embarrassing, Willem," Jude would say whenever he tried. "Let's just do it." He felt often as if their sessions together were being timed, and that his job was to perform as quickly and thoroughly as he could, and then never talk about it. He was less concerned with Jude's lack of erections than he was with the curious sensation he sometimes experienced, too indefinable and contradictory to even name it with language, that with every encounter they had, he was drawing closer to Jude, even as Jude pulled further from him. Jude said all the right things. He made all the right sounds. He was affectionate and willing. But still, Willem knew something was wrong. He found it bewildering. People had always enjoyed having sex with him. So what was happening here? Perversely, it made him want to have it more, if only so he could find some answers, even if he also dreaded them. And the same way he knew there was a problem with their sex life, he also knew without knowing, without ever being told, that Jude's cutting was related to the sex. This realization would always make him shiver, as would his old, careworn way of excusing himself, "Willem Ragnarsson, what do you think you're doing? You're too dumb to figure this out." From further exploration, from plunging an arm into the snake and centipede squirming muck of Jude's past, to find that many-paged book, sheathed in yellow plastic, that would explain someone he had thought he fundamentally understood. And then he would think how none of them, not he, not Malcolm, not J.B. or Richard, or even Harold, had been brave enough to try. They had found other reasons to keep themselves from having to dirty their hands. Andy was the only person who could say otherwise. And yet it was easy for him to pretend, to ignore what he knew, because most of the time pretending was easy, because they were friends, because they liked being around each other, because he loved Jude, because they had a life together, because he was attracted to him, because he desired him. But there was the Jude he knew in the daylight, and even in the dusk and dawn, and then there was the Jude who possessed his friend for a few hours each night, and that Jude, he sometimes feared, was the real Jude, the one who haunted their apartment alone, the one whom he had watched draw the razor so slowly down his arm, his eyes wide with agony, the one whom he could never reach, no matter how many reassurances he made, no matter how many threats he levied. It sometimes seemed as if it was that Jude who truly directed their relationship, and when he was present, no one, Not even Willem could dispel him. And still he remained stubborn. He would banish him through the intensity and the force of the determination of his love. He knew this was childish, but all stubborn acts are childish acts. Here, stubbornness was his only weapon. Patience, stubbornness, love. He had to believe these would be enough. He had to believe that they would be stronger than any habit of Jude's, no matter how long or diligently practiced. Sometimes he was given progress reports of sorts from Andy and Harold, both of whom thanked him whenever they saw him, which he found unnecessary but reassuring, because it meant that the changes he thought he saw in Jude, a heightened sense of demonstrativeness, a certain diminishment of physical self-consciousness, weren't things he was imagining after all. But he also felt keenly alone, alone with his new suspicions about Jude and the depths of his difficulties, alone with the knowledge that he was unable or unwilling to properly address those difficulties. A few times he had been very close to contacting Andy and asking him what to do, asking him whether he was making the right decisions, but he hadn't. Instead, he allowed his native optimism to obscure his fears, to make their relationship into something essentially joyous and sunny. Often he was struck by the sensation, which he had experienced at Lispenard Street as well, that they were playing house, that he was living some boyhood fantasy of running away from the world and its rules with his best friend, and living in some unsuitable but perfectly commodious structure, a train car, a tree house, that wasn't meant to be a home, but had become one because of its occupants' shared conviction to make it so. Mr. Irvine hadn't been entirely wrong, he would think on those days when life felt like an extended slumber party, one they'd been having for almost 3 decades, one that gave him the thrilling feeling that they had gotten away with something large, something they were meant to have abandoned long ago. You went to parties, and when someone said something ridiculous, you'd look across the table, and he'd look back at you, expressionless, with just the barest hint of a raised eyebrow, and you'd have to hurriedly drink some water to keep from spewing out your mouthful of food with laughter. And then back at your apartment, your ridiculously beautiful apartment, which you both appreciated an almost embarrassing amount for reasons you never had to explain to the other, you would recap the entire awful dinner, laughing so much that you began to equate happiness with pain. Or you got to discuss your problems every night with someone smarter and more thoughtful than you, or talk about the continued awe and discomfort you both felt all these years later about having money, absurd comic book villain money, or drive up to his parents' house, one of you plugging into the car's stereo an outlandish playlist with which you would both sing along loudly, being extravagantly silly as adults the way you never were as children. As you got older, you realized that really, there were very few people you truly wanted to be around for more than a few days at a time, and yet here you were with someone you wanted to be around for years, even when he was at his most opaque and confusing. So, happy. Yes, he was happy. He didn't have to think about it, not really. He was, he knew, a simple person, the simplest of people. And yet he had ended up with the most complicated of people. All I want, he'd said to Jude one night, trying to explain the satisfaction that at that moment was burbling inside him, like water in a bright blue kettle, is work I enjoy, and a place to live, and someone who loves me. See? Simple. Jude had laughed, sadly. Willem, he said. That's all I want, too. But you have that, he'd said, quietly. And Jude was quiet, too. Yes, he said, at last. You're right. But he hadn't sounded convinced. That Tuesday night, they are lying next to each other, half talking and half not, in one of the meandering, almost conversations they have when they both want to stay awake but are both falling asleep, when Jude says his name with a sort of seriousness that makes him open his eyes. "What is it?" he asks him, and Jude's face is so still, so sober, that he is frightened. "Jude," he says, "tell me." "Willem, you know I've been trying not to cut myself," he says, and Willem nods at him and waits. "And I'm going to keep trying," Jude continues. "But sometimes I might not be able to control myself." "I know," he says. "I know you're trying. I know how hard it is for you." Jude turns from him then, and Willem rolls over and wraps his arms around him. "I just want you to understand if I make a mistake," Jude says, and his voice is muffled. "Of course I will," he says. "Jude, of course I will." There is a long silence, and he waits to see if Jude will say anything else. He is thin, with a marathon runner's long muscles, but in the past 6 months, he has become thinner still, almost as thin as when he was released from the hospital, and Willem holds him a little tighter. "You've lost more weight," he tells him. "Work," Jude says, and they are quiet again. "I think you should eat more," he says. He had to gain weight to play touring, and although he's lost some of it, he feels massive beside Jude, something puffed and expansive. "Andy's going to think I'm not doing a good job taking care of you, and he's going to yell at me," he adds, and Jude makes a sound he thinks is a laugh. The next morning, the day before Thanksgiving, they are both cheery. They both like driving, and load their bag and the boxes of cookies and pies and breads that Jude has baked for Harold and Julia into the car and set off early, the car bouncing east over the cobblestone streets of Soho and then whooshing up the FDR Drive, singing along to the duet soundtrack. Outside Worcester, they stop at a gas station, and Jude goes in to buy them mints and water. He waits in the car, leafing through the paper, and when Jude's phone rings, he reaches over and sees who it is and answers it. "Have you told Willem yet?" he hears Andy's voice saying even before he can say hello. "You have 3 more days after today, Jude, and then I'm telling him myself. I mean it." "Andy?" he says, and there is a sudden, sharp silence. "Willem," Andy says. "Fuck." In the background, he can hear a small child's delighted voice trill out, "Uncle Andy said a bad word," and then Andy swears again, and he can hear a door sliding shut. "Why are you answering Jude's phone?" Andy asks. "Where is he?" "We're driving up to Harold and Julia's," he says. "He's getting water." On the other end, there is silence. "Tell me what, Andy?" he asks. "Willem," Andy says, and stops. "I can't. I told him I'd let him do it." "Well, he hasn't said anything to me," he says, and he can feel himself fill with strata of emotions. Fear, layered upon irritation, layered upon fear, layered upon curiosity, layered upon fear. "Andy, you'd better tell me," he says. Something in him starts to panic. "Is it bad?" he asks. And then he begins to plead. "Andy, don't do this to me!" He hears Andy breathing slowly. "Willem," he says quietly. "Ask him how he really got the burn on his arm. I have to go." "Andy!" he yells. "Andy!" But he's gone. He twists his head and looks out the window and sees Jude walking toward him. The burn, he thinks. What about the burn? Jude had gotten it when he tried to make the fried plantains JB likes. "Fucking JB," he'd said, seeing the bandage wrapped around Jude's arm. "Always fucking everything up." And Jude had laughed. "Seriously, though," he'd said, "are you okay, Judy?" And Jude had said he was. He had gone to Andy's, and they had done a graft with some artificial skin-like material. They'd had an argument then, that Jude hadn't told him how serious the burn was. From Jude's email, he had assumed it was a singe, certainly not something worthy of a skin graft, and another one this morning when Jude insisted on driving, even though his arm was still clearly hurting him. But what about the burn? And then suddenly he realizes that there is only one way to interpret Andy's words, and he has to quickly lower his head because he is as dizzy as if someone had just hit him. "Sorry," Jude says, easing back into the car. "The line took forever." He shakes the mints out of the bag and then turns and sees him. "Willem?" he asks. "What's wrong? You look terrible." "Andy called," he says, and he watches Jude's face, watches it become stony and scared. "Jude?" he says, and his own voice sounds far away, as if he's speaking from the depths of a gulch. "How did you get the burn on your arm?" But Jude won't answer him, just stares at him. "This isn't happening," he tells himself. But of course it is. "Jude," he repeats, "how did you get the burn on your arm?" But Jude only keeps staring at him, his lips closed, and he asks again and again. Finally, "Jude!" he shouts, astonished by his own fury, and Jude ducks his head. "Jude, tell me! Tell me right now!" And then Jude says something so quietly he can't hear him. "Louder!" he shouts at him. "I can't hear you!" "I burned myself," Jude says at last, very softly. "How?" he asks, wildly. And once again, Jude's answer is delivered in such a low voice that he misses most of it, but he can still distinguish certain words. Olive oil, match, fire. "Why?" he yells, desperately. "Why did you do this, Jude?" He is so angry, at himself, at Jude, that for the first time since he has known him, he wants to hit him. He can see his fists smashing into Jude's nose, into his cheek. He wants to see his face shattered, and he wants to be the one to do it.
"I was trying not to cut myself," Jude says, tinily, and this makes him newly livid.
"So it's my fault?" he asks. "You're doing this to punish me?"
"No," Jude pleads with him. "No, Willem, no, I just..."
But he interrupts him.
"Why have you never told me who Brother Luke is?"
he hears himself ask. He can tell that Jude is startled.
"What?"
he asks.
"You promised me you would,"
he says.
"Remember? It was my birthday present."
The final words sound more sarcastic than he intended.
"Tell me,"
he says.
"Tell me right now."
"I can't, Willem,"
Jude says.
"Please, please."
He sees that Jude is in agony, and still he pushes.
"You've had 4 years to figure out how to do it,"
he says. And as Jude moves to put the keys in the ignition, he reaches over and snatches them from him.
"I think that's enough of a grace period. Tell me right now."
And then, when there is still no reaction, he shouts at Jude again.
"Tell me!"
"He was one of the brothers at the monastery," Jude whispers.
"And?"
he screams at him.
"I am so stupid,"
he thinks, even as he yells.
"I am so, so stupid. I am so gullible."
And then, simultaneously,
"He's scared of me.
I'm yelling at someone I love and making him scared of me."
He suddenly remembers yelling at Andy all those years ago.
"You're mad because you can't figure out how to make him better, and so you're taking it out on me."
"Oh, God,"
he thinks.
"Oh, God. Why am I doing this?" "And I ran away with him,"
Jude says, his voice so faint now that Willem has to lean in to hear him.
"And?"
he says. But he can see that Jude is about to cry, and suddenly he stops and leans back, exhausted and disgusted with himself, and suddenly frightened as well.
What if the next question he asks is the question that finally opens the gate? and everything he has ever wanted to know about Jude, everything he has never wanted to confront, comes surging out at last. They sit there for a long time, the car filling with their shaky breaths. He can feel his fingertips turning numb.
"Let's go," he finally says.
"Where?" Jude asks, and Willem looks at him. "We only have an hour to Boston," he says, "and they're expecting us." And Jude nods, and wipes his face with his handkerchief, and takes the keys from him, and drives them slowly out of the gas station. As they move down the highway, he has a sudden vision of what it really means to set yourself on fire. He thinks of the campfires he had built as a Boy Scout, the teepee of twigs you'd arrange around a knot of newspaper, the way the shimmering flames made the air around them wobbly, their awful beauty. And then he thinks of Jude doing that to his own skin, imagines orange chewing through his flesh, and he is sick.
"Pull over,"
he gasps to Jude, and Jude screeches off the road and he leans out of the car and vomits until he has nothing more to expel.
"Willem,"
he hears Jude saying, and the sound of his voice enrages him and devastates him, both. They are silent for the rest of the drive, and when Jude pulls the car bumpily into Harold and Julia's driveway, there is a brief moment in which they look at each other, and it is as if he is looking at someone he has never seen before. He looks at Jude and sees a handsome man with long hands and legs and a beautiful face, the kind of face you look at and keep looking at, and if he were meeting this man at a party or at a restaurant, he would talk to him, because it would be an excuse to keep looking at him. And he would never think that this man would be someone who cut himself so much that the skin on his arms no longer felt like skin, but cartilage, or that he once dated someone who beat him so hard he could have died, or that one night he rubbed his skin with oil so that the flame he touched to his own body would burn brighter and faster, and that he had gotten this idea from someone who had once done this very thing to him years ago when he was a child and had done nothing worse than take something shiny and irresistible from a loathed and loathsome guardian's desk. He opens his mouth to say something when they hear Harold and Julia calling out their welcomes to them, and they both blink and turn and get out of the car, fixing their mouths into smiles as they do. As he kisses Julia, he can hear Harold, behind him, saying to Jude, "Are you okay? Are you sure? You look a little off." And then Jude's murmured assent. He goes to the bedroom with their bag, and Jude goes directly to the kitchen. He takes out their toothbrushes and electric razors and puts them in the bathroom, and then he lies down on the bed. He sleeps all afternoon. He is too overwhelmed to do anything else. Dinner is just the four of them, and he looks in the mirror, quickly practicing his laugh before he joins the others in the dining room. Over dinner, Jude is very quiet, but Willem tries to talk and listen as if everything is normal, though it is difficult, and his mind is full of what he has learned. Even through his rage and despair, he registers that Jude has almost nothing on his plate, but when Harold says, "Jude, you have to eat more. You've gotten way too skinny, right, Willem?" and looks to him for the support and cajoling he would normally reflexively offer, he instead shrugs. "Jude's an adult," he says, his voice odd to him. "He knows what's best for him." And out of the corner of his eyes, he sees Julia and Harold exchange glances with each other, and Jude look down at his plate. "I ate a lot when I was cooking," he says, and they all know this is untrue, because Jude never snacks while he's cooking, and doesn't let anyone else do so either. The snack Stasi, JB calls him. He watches Jude absent-mindedly cup his hand around his sweatered arm, right where the burn would be, and then he looks up and sees Willem staring, and drops his hand and looks back down again. Somehow they get through dinner, and as he and Julia do the dishes, he keeps the conversation topical and light. After, they go to the living room, where Harold is waiting for him to watch the previous weekend's game, which he has recorded. At the entryway to the room, he pauses. Normally, he would join Jude and squash in beside him on the oversized, overstuffed chair that has been squished in next to what they call Harold's chair. But tonight, he cannot sit next to Jude. He can barely look at him. And yet, if he doesn't, Harold and Julia will know for certain that something is seriously wrong between them. But as he hesitates, Jude stands and, as if anticipating his quandary, announces that he's tired and is going to bed. "Are you sure?" Harold asks. "The evening's just beginning." But Jude says he is, and kisses Julia goodnight, and waves vaguely in Harold and Willem's direction, and once again he sees Harold and Julia look at each other. Julia eventually leaves him as well. She has never understood the appeal of American football, and after she goes, Harold pauses the game and looks over at him. "Is everything okay with you two?" he asks, and Willem nods. Later, when he too is going to bed, Harold reaches out his hand for his own as he passes him. "You know, Willem," he says, squeezing his palm, "Jude's not the only one we love." And he nods again, his vision blurring, and tells Harold good night and leaves. Their bedroom is silent, and for a while he stands, staring at Jude's form beneath the blanket. Willem can tell he's not actually asleep. He is too still to actually be sleeping, but is pretending to be, and finally he undresses, folding his clothes over the back of the chair near the dresser. When he slips into bed, he can tell Jude is still awake, and the two of them lie there for a long time, on their opposite sides of the bed, both of them afraid of what he, Willem, might say. He sleeps, though, and when he wakes, the room is more silent still, a real silence this time, and out of habit, he rolls toward Jude's side of the bed and opens his eyes when he realizes that Jude isn't there, and that, in fact, his side of the bed is cool. He sits. He stands. He hears a small sound, too small to even be named as sound, and then he turns and sees the bathroom door closed. But all is dark. He goes to the door anyway, and fiercely turns the knob, slams it open, and the towel that's been jammed under the door to blot out the light trails after it like a train. And there, leaning against the bathtub, is Jude, as he knew he would be, fully dressed, his eyes huge and terrified. "Where is it?" he spits at him, although he wants to moan, he wants to cry, at his failing, at this horrible, grotesque play that is being performed night after night after night, for which he is the only accidental audience. Because even when there is no audience, the play is staged anyway to an empty house, its sole performer so diligent and dedicated that nothing can prevent him from practicing his craft.
"I'm not," Jude says, and Willem knows he's lying. "Where is it, Jude?" he asks,
and he crouches before him, seizes his hands. Nothing. But he knows he has been cutting himself. He knows it from how large his eyes are, from how gray his lips are, from how his hands are shaking.
"I'm not, Willem, I'm not," Jude says.
They are speaking in whispers so they won't wake Julia and Harold one flight above them, and then, before he can think, he is tearing at Jude, trying to pull his clothes away from him. And Jude is fighting him, but he can't use his left arm at all, and isn't at his strongest anyway, and they are screaming at each other with no sound. He is on top of Jude then, working his knees into his shoulders the way a fight master on a set once taught him to do, a method he knows both paralyzes and hurts. And then he is stripping Jude's clothes off, and Jude is frantic beneath him, threatening and then begging him to stop. He thinks dully that anyone watching them would think this was a rape. But he isn't trying to rape, he reminds himself. He is trying to find the razor. And then he hears it, the ping of metal on tile, and he grabs the edge of it between his fingers and throws it behind him, and then goes back to undressing him, yanking his clothes away with a brutal efficiency that surprises him even as he does it. But it isn't until he pulls down Jude's underwear that he sees the cuts. 6 of them, in neat, parallel, horizontal stripes, high on his left thigh. And he releases Jude and scuttles away from him as if he is diseased.
"You are crazy," he says, flatly and slowly, after his initial shock has lessened somewhat. "You're crazy, Jude. To cut yourself on your legs, of all places? You know what can happen. You know you can get infected there. What the hell are you thinking?"
He is gasping with exertion, with misery.
"You're sick,"
he says, and he is recognizing, again as if Jude is a stranger, how thin he really is, and wondering why he hadn't noticed before.
"You're sick. You need to be hospitalized. You need... Stop trying to fix me, Willem,"
Jude spits back at him.
"What am I to you? Why are you with me anyway? I'm not your goddamn charity project. I was doing just fine without you." "Oh, yeah?"
he asks.
"Sorry if I'm not living up to being the ideal boyfriend, Jude. I know you prefer your relationships heavy on the sadism, right? Maybe if I kicked you down the stairs a few times, I'd be living up to your standards."
He sees Jude move back from him then, pressing himself hard against the tub, sees something in his eyes flatten and close.
"I'm not hemming, Willem," Jude hisses at him. "I'm not going to be the cripple you get to save for the one you couldn't."
He rocks back on his heels then, stands, backs away, scooping up the razor as he does and then throwing it as hard as he can at Jude's face, Jude bringing his arms up to shield himself, the razor bouncing off his palm.
"Fine," he pants. "Fucking cut yourself to ribbons for all I care. You love the cutting more than you love me anyway."
He leaves, wishing he could slam the door behind him, banging off a light switch as he goes. Back in the bedroom, he grabs his pillows and one of the blankets from the bed and flings himself down on the sofa. If he could leave altogether, he would, but Harold and Julia's presence stops him, so he doesn't. He turns face down and screams, really screams, into the pillow, hitting his fists and kicking his legs against the cushions like a child having a tantrum, his rage mingling with a regret so complete that he is breathless. He is thinking many things, but he cannot articulate or distinguish any of them. And 3 successive fantasies spool quickly through his mind. He will get in the car and escape and never talk to Jude again. He will go back into the bathroom and hold him until he acquiesces, until he can heal him. He will call Andy now, right now, and have Jude committed first thing in the morning. But he does none of those things, just beats and kicks uselessly, as if he is swimming in place. At last he stops and lies still, and finally, after what feels like a very long time, he hears Jude creep into the room, as soft and slow as something beaten, a dog perhaps, some unloved creature who lives only to be abused, and then the creak of the bed as he climbs into it. The long, ugly night lurches on, and he sleeps, a shallow, furtive slumber, and when he wakes, it isn't quite daylight, but he pulls on his clothes and running shoes and goes outside, wrung dry with exhaustion, trying not to think of anything. As he runs, tears, whether from the cold or from everything, intermittently cloud his vision, and he rubs his eyes angrily, keeps going, making himself go faster, inhaling the wind in large, punishing gulps, feeling its ache in his lungs. When he returns, he goes back to their room, where Jude is still lying on his side, curled into himself, and for a second he imagines, with a jolt of horror, that he is dead, and is about to speak his name, when Jude shifts a bit in his sleep, and he instead goes to the bathroom and showers, packs his running clothes into their bag, dresses for the day, and goes to the kitchen, shutting the bedroom door quietly behind him. There in the kitchen is Harold, who offers him a cup of coffee, as he always does, and as always, since he began his relationship with Jude, he shakes his head. Although right now just the smell of coffee, its woody, barky warmth, makes him almost ravenous. Harold doesn't know why he stopped drinking it, only that he has, and is always, as he says, trying to lead him back down the road to temptation, and although normally he would joke around with him, this morning he doesn't. He can't even look at Harold, he is so ashamed, and he is resentful as well. Of Harold's unspoken, but, he senses, unshakable expectation that he will always know what to do about Jude. The disappointment, the disdain he knows Harold would feel for him if he knew what he had said and done in the nighttime. "You don't look great," Harold tells him. "I'm not," he says. "Harold, I'm really sorry. Kit texted late last night, and this director I thought I was going to meet up with this week is leaving town tonight. I have to get back to the city today."
"Oh, no, Willem, really?" Harold begins, and then Jude walks in, and Harold says, "Willem says you guys have to go back to the city this morning."
"You can stay," he says to Jude, but doesn't lift his eyes from the toast he's buttering.
"Keep the car, but I need to get back."
"No," says Jude, after a short silence. "I should get back too."
"What the hell kind of Thanksgiving is this? You guys just eat and run? What am I going to do with all that turkey?"
Harold says, but his theatrical outrage is muted, and Willem can feel him looking at both of them in turn, trying to figure out what's happening, what's gone wrong. He waits for Jude to get ready, trying to make small talk with Julia and ignore Harold's unspoken questions. He goes to the car first to make it clear he's driving, and as he's saying goodbye, Harold looks at him and opens his mouth, and then shuts it, and hugs him instead.
"Drive safely," he says.
In the car he seethes, keeps accelerating, and then reminding himself to slow down. It's not even 8 in the morning, and it's Thanksgiving Day, and the highway is empty. Next to him, Jude is turned away from him, his face against the glass. Willem still hasn't looked at him, doesn't know what expression he wears. Can't see the smudges under his eyes that Andy had told him in the hospital were a telltale sign that Jude has been cutting himself too much. His anger quickens and recedes by the mile. Sometimes he sees Jude lying to him. He is always lying to him, he realizes, and the fury fills him like hot oil. And sometimes he thinks of what he said, and the way he behaved, and the entire situation, that the person he loves is so terrible to himself, and feels such a sense of remorse that he has to grip the steering wheel to make himself focus. He thinks, "Is he right? Do I see him as Hemming?" And then he thinks, "No. That's Jude's delusion, because he can't understand why anyone would want to be with him. It's not the truth, but the explanation doesn't comfort him, and indeed makes him more wretched." Just past New Haven, he stops. Normally, the passage through New Haven is the opportunity for him to recount their favorite stories from when he and JB were roommates in grad school. The time he was made to help JB and Asian Henry Young mount their guerrilla exhibition of swaying carcasses of meat outside of the medical college. The time JB cut off all his dreads and left them in the sink until Willem finally cleaned them up 2 weeks later. The time he and JB danced to techno music for 40 straight minutes so JB's friend Greg, a video artist, could record them.
"Tell me the one when JB filled Richard's tub with tadpoles," Jude would say, grinning in anticipation. "Tell me the one about the time you dated that lesbian. Tell me the one when JB crashed that feminist orgy."
But today neither of them says anything, and they roll past New Haven in silence. He gets out of the car to gas up and go to the bathroom.
"I'm not stopping again," he tells Jude, who hasn't moved,
but Jude only shakes his head, and Willem slams the door shut, his anger returning.
They are at Green Street before noon, and they get out of the car in silence, into the elevator in silence, into the apartment in silence. He takes their bag to the bedroom. Behind him, he can hear Jude sit down and begin playing something on the piano. Schumann, he recognizes. Fantasy in C. A pretty vigorous number for someone who's so wan and helpless, he thinks sourly, and realizes he has to get out of the apartment. He doesn't even take his coat off, just heads back into the living room with his keys. I'm going out, he says, but Jude doesn't stop playing. Do you hear me? He shouts. I'm leaving. Then Jude looks up, stops playing.
When are you coming back?
He asks quietly, and Willem feels his resolve weaken. But then he remembers how angry he is. I don't know, he says. Don't wait up. He punches the button for the elevator. There is a pause, and then Jude resumes playing. And then he is out in the world, and all the stores are closed, and Soho is quiet. He walks to the West Side Highway, walks up it in silence, his sunglasses on, his scarf, which he bought in Jaipur, a gray for Jude, a blue for him, and which is of such soft cashmere that it snags on even the slightest of stubble, wrapped around his stubbly neck. He walks and walks. Later, he won't even remember what he thought about, if he thought about anything. When he is hungry, he veers east to buy a slice of pizza, which he eats on the street, hardly tasting it, before returning to the highway. This is my world, he thinks, as he stands at the river and looks across it toward New Jersey. This is my little world, and I don't know what to do in it. He feels trapped. And yet how can he feel trapped when he can't even negotiate the small place he occupies? How can he hope for more when he can't comprehend what he thought he did? Nightfall is abrupt and brief, and the wind more intense, and still he walks. He wants warmth, food, a room with people laughing. But he can't bear to go into a restaurant, not by himself on Thanksgiving, not in the mood he's in. He'll be recognized, and he doesn't have the energy for the small talk, the bonhomie, the graciousness that such encounters will necessitate. His friends have always teased him about his invisibility claim, his idea that he can somehow manipulate his own visibility, his own recognizability. But he had really believed it, even when evidence kept disproving him. Now he sees this belief as yet more proof of his self-deception, his way of constantly pretending that the world will align itself to his vision of it, that Jude will get better because he wants him to, that he understands him because he likes to think he does, that he can walk through Soho and no one will know who he is. But really, he is a prisoner of his job, of his relationship, and mostly of his own willful naivete. Finally, he buys a sandwich and catches a taxi south to Perry Street, to his apartment that is barely his anymore. In a few weeks, in fact, it no longer will be, because he has sold it to McGill, his friend from Spain, who is spending more time in the States. But tonight it still is, and he lets himself in, cautiously, as if the apartment may have deteriorated, may have started breeding monsters since he was last there. It is early, but he takes off his clothes anyway, and picks Miguel's clothes off Miguel's chaise longue, and takes Miguel's blanket off Miguel's bed, and lies down on the chaise, letting the helplessness and tumult of the day, only a day, and so much has happened, descend, and cries. As he's crying, his phone rings, and he gets up, thinking it might be Jude, but it's not. It's Andy.
Andy, he cries. I fucked up. I really fucked up. I did something horrible.
Willem, Andy says gently, I'm sure it's not as bad as you think it is. I'm sure you're being too hard on yourself. so he tells Andy, haltingly, explaining what has happened, and after he is finished, Andy is silent. "Oh, Willem," he sighs, but he doesn't sound angry, only sad. "Okay, it is as bad as you think it is." And for some reason, this makes him laugh a little, but then also moan. "What should I do?" he asks, and Andy sighs again. "If you want to stay with him, I'd go home and talk to him," he says, slowly. "And if you don't want to stay with him, I'd go home and talk to him anyway." He pauses. "Willem, I'm really sorry." "I know," he says. And then, as Andy's saying goodbye, he stops him. "Andy," he says, "tell me honestly, is he mentally ill?" There's a very long silence until Andy says, "I don't think so, Willem. Or rather, I don't think there's anything chemically wrong with him. I think his craziness is all man-made." He is silent. "Make him talk to you, Willem," he says. "If he talks to you, I think you'll understand why he is the way he is." And suddenly he needs to get home, and he is dressing and hurrying out the door, hailing a cab and getting into it, getting out and getting into the elevator, opening the door and letting himself into the apartment, which is silent, disconcertingly silent. On the way over, he had a sudden image, one that felt like a premonition, that Jude had died, that he had killed himself. And he runs through the apartment shouting his name. "Willem?" he hears, and he runs through their bedroom, with their bed still made, and then sees Jude in the far left corner of their closet, curled up on the ground facing the wall. But he doesn't think about why he's there. He just drops to the floor next to him. He doesn't know if he has permission to touch him, but he does so anyway, wrapping his arms around him. "I'm sorry," he says to the back of Jude's head. "I'm so sorry. I'm so sorry. I didn't mean what I said. I would be distraught if you hurt yourself. I am distraught." He exhales. "And I never, ever should have gotten physical with you, Jude. I'm so sorry." "I'm sorry, too," Jude whispers, and they are silent. "I'm sorry about what I said. I'm sorry I lied to you, Willem." They are quiet for a long time. "Do you remember the time you told me you were afraid, that you were a series of nasty surprises for me?" he asks him. And Jude nods slightly. "You aren't," he tells him. "You aren't. But being with you is like being in this fantastic landscape," he continues slowly. "You think it's one thing, a forest, and then suddenly it changes, and it's a meadow or a jungle or cliffs of ice, and they're all beautiful, but they're strange as well, and you don't have a map. And you don't understand how you got from one terrain to the next so abruptly. And you don't know when the next transition will arrive, and you don't have any of the equipment you need. And so you keep walking through and trying to adjust as you go. But you don't really know what you're doing, and often you make mistakes, bad mistakes. That's sometimes what it feels like." They're silent. "So basically," Jude says at last, "basically you're saying I'm New Zealand." It takes him a second to realize Jude is joking, and when he does, he begins to laugh, unhingedly, with relief and sorrow, and he turns Jude toward him and kisses him. "Yes," he says, "yes, you're New Zealand." Then they are quiet again. And serious, but at least they are looking at each other. "Are you going to leave?" Jude asks, so quietly that Willem can barely hear him. He opens his mouth, shuts it. Oddly, even with everything he has thought and not thought over the last day and night, he has not considered leaving. And now he thinks about it. No, he says. And then, I don't think so.
And he watches Jude shut his eyes and then open them and nod.
Jude, he says, and the